So this next poem is about how we live in a revolutionary nation. The first revolutionary nation. I sometimes have these conversations with you, Matt, about how I'm confused and think this is the second, but you correct me.
Yeah, America actually created the nation state. It's pretty exciting, and we are the absolutely old crumbling guard. And France came soon after that, right? Yeah, this 1776 and 1798, the American and then French revolutions, right? Yeah. So we are traditionally revolutionary, but, you know, tradition and revolution sometimes don't go together that well. Sometimes.
The idea of this poem came about because I was, and I don't know when this was, I was driving with my friend Jen Rust, a really close friend of mine, and we were out somewhere like Riverside, and everyone had an SUV and all the homes looked the same. And we were talking about Marxist revolutions, and she was like, well, we don't need a revolution around here. We have one. Everyone's still participating in the American Revolution, you know, conforming to the revolutionary ideals of having the same home and having an equally large car. And maybe that's obvious or maybe it's strange, but it touched me because I'm a great patriot. So,
you know, on that subject, I had a really good friend by the name of Nader, who's Palestinian. And, of course, we would talk about, you know, America. And, you know, I was in a point where it was, like, so easy for me to just be like, yeah, America, it sucks. And he was able to kind of give me a little bit more of a rosy vision, you know. He, you know, reminding me that, you know what, really this is the biggest experiment in kind of multi-ethnic existence on the planet. You know, blah, 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 you know, all this stuff. And it actually made me kind of think back and say, yeah, in a way we are actually, still constantly participating in a revolutionary society. But some of us don't, I think, at times we forget that that's what we're doing.
And,
you know,
people forget, you know, what that revolutions are about, you know, violence. So if we're in a revolutionary society, don't we have always the need to, you know, exert violence against our other members of our society in order to make sure that everyone conforms to our revolutionary standards? And these are the kinds of ideas I'm getting at with this very patriotic poem. This is called 11 Revolutionary Burps. Even the poor must be continually attacked due to their stubborn unwillingness to conform to standards that they cannot afford. Each new fully private home in each new far-off suburb is a new fulfillment of the revolutionary requirement for individual fulfillment through conformist means, which is the beauty that ensures that national identity shall be implicit up and down the street. The rich, whose individuality and freedom is realized through the lifestyle earned by earning riches, nevertheless must conform to a deluxe version of the lifestyle fit for all. A general anger in defense of the nation must be conformed to. All leaders must conform to the choking passions fit for responsible parties when the coffins are unloaded from the boats. It is okay to dislike leaders, as long as they are disliked in the way that a candle smolders. The revolution must redeploy periodically by scorning old strongmen. Every leader has the prerogative to dip his hands in blood, blood of the foreign, blood of the different, although strictly speaking, the only relevant blood is the blood of patriots, but that will surely be spilled to obtain the foreign blood. Leaders shall not, even surreptitiously, dip their fingers in the blood of patriots, because their fingers might have germs on them, The entirely pure blood of patriots must be poured on roots of liberty to promote new revolutions. When a revolutionary nation creates a new revolutionary nation, the war between them begins at once, spilling the blood of patriots on both sides, enlivening the ideology of both. Even the gentle, who can never entirely conform to revolutionary standards that bless blood, must be continually attacked with ridicule, satire, parody, spoof, and other effeminate genres which are meaningful to them. Even the rich must conform to the blood sacrifice of youth by honoring it through public relations and advertising, even though they can never bear to part with their own beloved children, and therefore will never know the complete exaltation of revolutionary society when the body of the patriot's child is unloaded in a coffin from a boat, and the leader sends an unsigned note to confirm the fact. The rich, the poor, the gentle, despite the fact that they can never be completely patriots for the reasons named above, nevertheless must not know of their failure to conform, that their inadequacy to our standards may not be known to them. This slack majority must be the targets of eternal propaganda.
Yeah, that's great. I just want to just say a quick note about this poem. You know, when I read it, and now as you read it, I realize that one of the things that's great about your writing is that you hit multiple registers of, I don't know, kind of, it's, I think I said it a little bit earlier, but you seem to have a lot of voices going on within the poem all at once, and you're able to hit multiple registers of parody, multiple registers of serious statements, you know, and I think that it may be like almost, I want to say it's difficult to keep track of like what exactly register you're hitting at any one moment, because I don't think that's what's interesting. What's interesting is the juxtaposition of all these different kind of parodic and serious and ironic, sarcastic, registers, or you're aping the voice of some other kind of perspective, you know, doing that all at once, even within a sentence. Sometimes you will jump from one kind of like voice to another. It's I mean, I think it's really great. So, but
in this poem, it is like there is a sort of pro-war voice that comes into the poem, and that I allow to talk. I mean, I'm opposed to the current war, but I guess, you know, I'm not opposed to the idea that a nation would ever have war. I mean, I'm not a pure pacifist in that sense. I mean, I think I would be opposed to almost any war that the United States could conduct at this time, because they would all seem pretty much unnecessary. But then, you know, if it was a small nation and it was threatened, I mean, war would be something. But I don't know. Yeah, the pro-war voice in this poem then collides with this anti-war voice, and with feeling like people don't want to recognize what war is, and then the fear that the pro-war voice, in this poem, the pro-war voice loves war as a matter of aesthetics, not as a matter of necessity, but as a matter of the aesthetics of having a revolutionary society or a free society. And I think there is a large part of American society for whom any war that's offered to them, they'll really support without considering it necessary or not, as a matter of the aesthetics, of the right to have the aesthetics of war as a free country. And that's disturbing, because when you like aestheticize politics in that way, which the structure of our nation seems to demand almost, mm-hmm. You open the door to all kinds of, you know, awful political theater. I mean, not in the sense of you or I would do a play, but in the sense of like politicians performing roles that are political theater that get people killed. Anyway.
But that's propaganda, right? Which I feel like in your poetry, in this book, is sort of criticizing, which makes me think about poetry as propaganda.
This...
Well, you have a poem, the Power of Propaganda, about just a couple poems before this one in the book Inforation, and you know, kind of dealing with that, and again in using absurdist tactics that you tend to use by overinflating a certain position, but in 11 Revolutionary Burps, I mean, honestly, I don't really feel like you're overinflating all that much. It's just like you're applying it in a particular way when you talk about the blood of the patriots, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe we should move to I Am a Neoconservative.
Let's
the
do
poem,
that.
Not me stating that, but
I was just gonna respond to what you were saying.
Sure.
that when you write poetry that's about political topics, immediately you're in the territory of propaganda. So maybe some of the sort of absurdist or bizarre tactics are because of my discomfort with writing like propagandistic poetry. So to distance it from propaganda, I mean, you know, these kinds of experimental tactics, writing experiments, are obviously in a whole different register from propaganda. And you can kind of, I can be safe from propaganda while still touching on the issues that propaganda is about.
And that's a great point. And it brings up also, well, Matt brought up the absurdist tactics and then you followed up with that. And in terms of propaganda, the propaganda machine being able to consume everything in its path except absurdism. I mean, I don't think you would see a commercial on television where they're talking nonsense, at least not anytime in the near future. There may be at some point where even that tactic is, you know, taken in by capitalism or propaganda. But I can't imagine nonsense words ever being part of it.
Well, certain kinds of ideas and more certain ways of talking about ideas, I think, are actually kind of actively excluded, you know, by the TV or by whatever media organ within capitalism. And it's because, you know, capitalism doesn't really want to take in and subvert everything. There are a lot of things, I mean, I agree it wants to take in and subvert a lot of things, like the idea of rebellion or something, and patriotism, of course, it's all over all that. But there are lots of registers that it just tries to sort of push out to the margins and make them disappear, but, you know.
That's good, then. Then I'm a little bit less paranoid.
But this next poem is maybe propaganda, because I wrote it when I was mad. But it also has jokes. It's about, I was imagining if I was a neoconservative, you know, like in the Bush administration, and if one day, rather than you know, saying things that I knew were not true, you know, like if you think of like what's his name, Bill Frist, you know, who's so great at saying things that are ridiculous in retrospect, but which people buy at the time, you know, like the Iraqis will greet us with flowers, or within 6 months, the Iraqi oil industry will pay the costs of controlling Iraq. You know,
that happened.
I mean, nothing he ever says ever happens, but it's important to remember that the things he says are for that moment. They're for that moment. So I was imagining I was someone like him, and I wasn't going to be channeling my optimism that I'm, you know, good at channeling when the American people need optimism, and I was just going to speak my mind. So, not that this is him, you know. I mean, it's not a character assault on him. It's just neoconservatism as an ideology. I'm a neoconservative, and I believe that power has to be used in order to find out if it's really real. Back in the Cold War, there was a lot of bluffing and hype and talk about power. power on all sides, and sometimes some guerrillas would tangle with some mercenaries, and the victorious brotherhood would rub each other down with the blood of the slain in some backwater in Africa or Central America. And of course, that was an important moral test. They had real power, these mercenaries and or guerrillas, and they were admirable for that reason. They could return home to their women proud of the fact that they had raped the women of their enemies and hid them in holes and created magical objects to scare away the souls of the innocent children who otherwise might have counterattacked power as power tried to sleep. It's important to keep all the souls of the martyrs neutralized. The key is to hide their names under a pile of heavier names, the names of our own side's dead, like paperweights. And remember, never repeat your victim's name unless you have eaten part of him, because then it is only your own name and is safe. That is why all the Iraqis mentioned on television are alive. Spiritual security. But I'm no spiritualist. I'm a neoconservative. And while those third world fighters were demonstrating their manhood, the first and the second world were fighting a war of equivocations and thought balloons, full of angst and heavy, depressing silences, inevitable as Armageddon, which Ronald Reagan ultimately won by refusing to think as much as the enemy, and by taking refreshing naps. He was a wimp, but he can teach us one thing of value. The key to victory is not to waste time worrying. Because if you win, but your enemy has made you worry while you are winning, well then, terrorists won. Because the point of terrorism is to interfere with peace of mind, and therefore interfere with economic prosperity. Because who among us can get as much done while perpetually worrying about everything? I'm a neoconservative, and I let the troops do my worrying for me. They deal with the roadside bombs. I take care of more important matters, such as antagonizing France. I actually look forward to a world where a new Franco-Russian-German military alliance has created another power bloc big enough to be worth competing with, because I want to strike at them with manly savagery and without worry or consideration. That is, I want the troops to strike at them for me. The troops can be cowardly and civilized and worried and thoughtful if they want. It's natural and only human to be like that when you're facing death. I'll have enough strength for everyone, circling towns where every man and woman must lie down in a pool of their own blood, vanquished, clobbered, to prove how prosperous America is, because it takes a chunk of change to raise a village. I'm a neoconservative, and it's going to take a lot of treasure to demonstrate my manhood, because I really don't have much of it. Japan is going to have to loan us more than they've ever loaned us before. Luckily, as the dollar becomes devalued, the real value of our loan payments will be less. So that will be a good deal for us. Or will it? I don't worry about economics either. I think you're starting to see the nature of my style. If necessary, we can just tell our factories what to produce and pay them in paper. Suitcases full of bills, bills, bills. Did you know controlling the government means you can make as much money as you want? So cool! We should have them print a new $10,000 bill with George Bush's face on it, grinning at the people who are fine as wine. When it no longer makes sense to drive to work for a minimum wage job because the gas to get there costs 2/3 of the daily wage, join the army. 3 square meals a day, except during boot camp war games when the simulated suicide bomber blows up the dinner truck and everybody has to sleep on an empty stomach to remind them that the simulation is lifelike. I'm a neoconservative, and I never served in the army because I was saving myself up to be a wise counselor. My manhood has aged like a cheap Prosecco aged in a plastic canteen, and I'm getting tipsy on it.
Yeah, that's a great, I love this poem. I kind of forgot it. I've read it a couple times, but now hearing you read it again, I'm just laughing over here. You know, and this is something, I mean, we talked about, you know, using other voices and whatever, but really, like, when you get down to it, this is kind of like some of your other modes of writing, in that it's kind of like you're putting on a voice. I mean, it's dramatic. It's like you're writing a skit. It's like you're writing a speech for, say, a Bill Frist or a whatever, you know, for a neocon. You know, it's like a sock puppet. You know, you're just holding him up and let me tell you what I really think, you know. And there's some amazing lines in here, but I don't know.
It's a little similar to, I was doing this project, which was a series of skits or maybe like a series of very tiny plays, but skits, you know, and called Oracular Vagina Takes Her Place Among World Leaders. And there was this magical being who was a man who had gotten a sex change operation. And this is very absurd, if you want absurd. And this wasn't my idea. This is a friend's idea, my friend Russell Reed, because he wanted to do this for an opera. But this post-sex change transsexual has a talking vagina for magical reasons and talks to political figures. And so I was having fun, I guess, expressing my opinions, sort of, having these political figures chat with the vagina. And this is, I guess, similar to that work, you're right, in that I could have done a piece where Bill Frist was talking to the sock puppet or the vagina, but instead I just did it as monologue, like Robert Browning. And it uses Browning-type things, even though it's less realistic because there are little asides, you know, where Frist seems to be wandering off into his own thoughts about, you know, these battles in Africa and Central America, which are really bizarre. But it's not really like Browning because I don't really think it's the person. It's more like it's a parody, you know, of the person.
Yeah, and even this piece, and also maybe this piece, but also your Oracular Vagina piece, which I think can be found online, and also you have a chapbook of it. You know, the first time I read that stuff, it actually reminded me of, it's theater of the absurd. It's classic theater of the absurd. And it reminded me intimately of Alfred Jarry, you know, and his some of his earlier plays, which are just absolutely ridiculous and are constantly pointing out, you know, the absurdities in different people, points of view, you know, different styles of writing even. I mean, he would ape different writers to, you know, show the kind of absurdity of the form. Oftentimes it was the absurdity of an ideology. But, one of the things I find interesting about this is you're able to adopt voices. And then, and through that, you're able to say something like, we're fighting a war of equivocations and thought balloons, which, of course, no one would say, but that's, I'm sure, what the way they see it. You know, a war for their hearts and minds, you know, the war of the words. Like, I'd never heard that phrase until last few years, you know, directly on you know, nightly news. The war of the words has begun between, you know, North Korea and the Bush administration, blah, blah, blah.
And then
blah,
they
blah.
Quickly come up with a neat graphic.
Yeah.
The war of the words.
And it's probably thought balloons.
The funny thing about the war for hearts and minds is I remember when they were talking about that, and I was like, you know, pretty obviously very few Iraqis are having their hearts and minds turned to the U.S. by, you know, having bombs dropped on them or being put in Abu Ghraib or something. So I really felt that it was a kind of, really it was a war for Americans' hearts and minds, you know. but it was, we were talking about it as a war for their hearts and minds, which, and then I've always felt the Bush administration, it's so good at winning the war at home, the war of public opinion in terms of manipulating the media. And if they really put that kind of effort into winning a war abroad or controlling Iraq, they'd probably be very successful, but it's, I think it's a lesser concern. But you see how it falls into propaganda here.
Yeah.
This point.
Well, let's, maybe we should move on to their children we have learned.
Sure, this is not propaganda.
You should say that before you read each poem. From now on to the future.
At my readings.
This is not
also
propaganda.
Is not propaganda. This next poem will not be propaganda. Their children we have learned, maybe she doesn't like me much. Their children we have learned, sandwich offers for burn alliances. Maybe she doesn't like, have learned the beep tricks for my golo. Maybe she doesn't like their child with the congratulated eyes. We have sandwich offers. Their child with the congratulated eyes. We've been lonely wooing. Burn all eye in sizz, says Gizmo Gawpants. For burn alliances, have learned the importanter imagine. For burn alliances, the imagine gun my go. Their child with the congrats, wooing, worrying, counting hours of sleep. Their child the witch offers, wooing, worrying, willowing sleep streams, says Gizmo grammar plants, grow up in salvation's mortal soil. Says Gizmo grammar prance, don't call me, I'm clocked in yester key. Imagine gun my go, accelerate cognition, precognition. Imagine gun my go, homeless people, muffins in their pants, wooing, worrying, hool, shoes their child, for we have learned, wooing, worrying, hool, the road that awaits you, the suffering, have learned the importance. The point of prophecy is suffering. Have learned the import ant. You suffer because you're importanter. Accelerate cog knee. We have learned sandwich offers, ice meat stones. Accelerate correctness. Worrying who'll go my gun, imagine wooing. Grow up in salvation. Their child with the congrats who offers back. Obstacles of wise crack, efforts ended art form, poor low you to risk. Shoes their child for the road, art form with the congratulated eyes. Shoes their child for the road, pip squeak foundling saunters prophetically, no soap. Art form with the Kong rats, offers ice meat stones, muffins and congrats. Art form with the Kong rats, says Gizmo grammar palace words are cheese in sizz, says Gizmo gawpants plants. A grammar palace is a child who'll knee correctness, says Gizmo gawpants prance. Nothing's worse than a road full of sad prophecy. Risk to you, low poor art form. Imagine gun my go of stones in roads of prophecy. Stones in roads of sad, sad prophecy. Yours suffer because you're importanter. Shoes their child for the stones. Maybe she doesn't like me much for burn alliances. Choose their child for the sown. An eyeball gizmo grammar palace cheese our knees. Knees are for kneeling with. I'm clocked in yester key with kneeing palaces. It all tastes the same real. Their child, their gizmo, the witch offers back cheese. Stones, gun, shoes, go, stones, cog. Ga have learned she doesn't like. Jesus turns stones to cheese. It all tastes the same real eyeball, gizmo, ga, prophecy.
Yeah, that's great. I love this piece. This poem makes me wonder about your process for some of these, because it is so pleasantly absurd. And, for example, Gizmo Gawpants. I mean, this person, this figure, becomes something in my mind. What I can't say at the moment, I'm sure it has to do with Muppets. But what were you going to say, Matt?
Well, I was going to say also, I mean, maybe we'll post this on the LA Lit website, but it looks completely unlike any of the other poems. You have one other poem in this book that looks like this, and it looks like a cut-up. You know, there's columns on two sides of the page, and it's kind of little stanzas there, and it feels like a cut-up poem, but I'm not really sure if that's what it is. So if you want to talk about that, like you said, about the process.
Yeah, process.
I know I wrote this around, I think it was from about 2 to 3 in the morning, and I know I had some material. Like, I had something in another file, but I don't really know what the material I was using was. But clearly I cut it up a lot, and then I was improvising a lot off the base. It seems like it's structured around, like, associations that are sonic associations. Like, I'll bring in new words just because they sound like words I've used, and then it'll seem like they'll bring up new meaning associations. But also maybe there's a kind of sense that there's a moment where it's pipsqueak foundling saunters prophetically no soap, which I don't know what that means, but a lot of the things have to do with kids and maybe these kind of narratives of you know, the lost child who, like all those old 18th century novels, like Tom Jones, you know, he's the foundling and he has these special abilities, and that's such a common trope. So I think that ran through here. And so then religion comes in, and, you know, and then there's just a lot of stuff. Words.
Also, it brings up something which I noticed running throughout the book, which is something like, I don't want to say a rebellion against, but maybe against the idea of sort of romantic individual expression, you know, expressing yourself. In this book, I feel something else is foregrounded. Not just, well, it becomes political, but it's not just political. And when we talk, you mentioned collectivism.
We're saying the book, I mean, it seems like it's not the poet, you know, making observations, and but that it feels like this, that the poetic voice is more collective in general, because, and this poem is a great place. I mean, you know, we've talked about it earlier, talking about how it feels like there's so many different voices in the poems. It seems like, you know, you're kind of coming from this collective mentality. Now, I'm not saying you have a lot of voices in your head or something, which you might, I don't know. But, yeah, it's just, especially this one, I mean, it seems like they're children we have learned, this poem. It seems like it's just not coming from, like, I. I mean, I think what you said, something about
Well, the death of the individual, but it sounds so dramatic or whatever.
The death of the individual. Well, there's a point in this poem where it's like wooing, worrying, who'll, which gets repeated, like who'll as in who will. And so for this poem, maybe the identification is with who, like who's talking, who's listening, me not knowing who's talking, not knowing who's listening. It's sort of, it's more in that direction of throwing things open to the reader than most of the book, because most of the book is more organized in terms of throwing things open to the reader, letting the reader interpret different lines or different statements. And I think you're right that they're not meant to be coming from one speaker, definitely. in a lot of the poems, it's that different statements could almost be coming from different directions at the reader. I'm doing silly arm movements, which you can't hear if you're listening.
He's illustrating the concept rather well.
I'm pointing at my head from different directions. But here it was more like it was late at night, and so I was seeing what kind of voices were rolling out in my head.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. And then, you know, and then not knowing what kind of person might listen.
See, I also find this interesting. You were writing this at like 3 a.m, he said, or yeah. Like in the middle of the night. You know, I just have to, this maybe an aside, but relates here. It's something that Jen Hoffer mentioned at one of her readings at her house. She has this, she got this, I swear she said it was in a workshop with Bernadette Meyer, where a bunch of poets agreed to, throughout the month of August, always wake up at 3 a.m. and write for an hour, or like a half an hour or something. Or no, it was 3:15. It had to be 3:15. And they've got at least one book of different poets that have actually kept that tradition up, and she's been doing it. She's been doing it for like 7 years, and she said whoever she's with at the time, you know, everybody hate, you know, if she's with someone for a while, they hate her during the month of August because she gets up at 3:15 a.m. and she lays in bed and writes. And even she said, like, she read some of those pieces at a reading at her house a couple weeks ago. And one of the things that was interesting, she said, like, I don't recognize this voice at all. It's something about, and, you know, we all know this, but something about when you, you know, middle of the night or something, you know, these voices coming from somewhere else. And, I mean, to me, Jen's poetry still sounded like Jen, and this piece that you're saying you wrote in the middle of it still sounds like you, and yet at the same time it does give a different kind of dimension to the poet's voice, and kind of maybe takes it out of the simple kind of I am the poet. Not that you do this in the rest of the book, but
which yeah. brings up the idea of collaboration, even when you're flying solo, the notion of collaboration sort of infiltrating the work that you do alone. But I also know that you do a lot of collaborations. Maybe you could talk about that too.
I do, yeah. Yeah, this last poem's not a collaboration, but I guess I was letting my asleep voice collaborate with my awake voice, so that's something. Everyone has an asleep voice, right?
Yeah.
Maybe not. As far as collaborating, I do a lot of collaborative things. I have this website I'm doing with my friend Marco, and I are doing a project called Bed Bird Bed, where he puts up drawings he's made, though they're full color drawings, and I'll write a poem for each one. And the strategy I have is the first time I see it, or at latest the second time, I'll just look at it and start composing a line that seems to describe in an abstract way whatever image, and then I'll flash back and forth between looking at the painting and writing lines until I've produced a poem. And I've done a lot of those, 54, and it helps that I know Russell and his pictures are very strange. And I've done other collaborations. When I was doing Oracular Vagina with my friend Russell, he was I was doing it for him, so he was suggesting politicians I should have the Oracle talk to. And then another friend of mine, Jessie Guilford, did her own series of Oracular Vagina adventures. And then for a while, it was going to be one huge collaborative book where the two of us had written things, and there was going to be a third author. And, you know, and we wrote hundreds and hundreds of pages, and then we woke up to the fact that probably being an unpublished author or nearly unpublished is bad enough without trying to sell publishers' books with four authors, you know. So we had to divide it back up. But and I'm doing a thing with Matthew Timmons. I don't know if either of you know him, but we imagine.
I do. I know that guy.
Hey, I'm doing a thing with Matthew Timmons too.
Collaboration. Yeah. It's great to work with other people because I think it makes a person more productive because you can steal their ideas, which is really great.
In fact, all of us here have multiple collaborations going on between each other at the same time. And what you just said, I mean, I think the best thing about collaborating is that you get to bounce your, whatever your writing kind of style is, against someone else's. And sad, I think the real truth is you get, like you said, you get to steal their style for a little bit, you know, and see how it works with your own. And you know, it's similar to, like, when you read an author, you read, like, three of their books in a row, and then everything you write sounds like them. But hopefully then, you know, you read some other author, and then everything you write sounds like this new author plus a dash of the author that you read a little bit before. It's kind of, you know, it's like, it's similar. It's like when you collaborate with someone, you get to see how they work and kind of try to work similarly to them, which only expands your ability, right? You know?
So. But it also, I think, subverts the notion of pure style, which I think was previously more hip. You know, now it's getting to be more cut up and...
Right. Well, my style's a mess. I live in fear of being judged by a pure stylist because I think I would be a ridiculous mongrel who can't make up his mind about what kind of writing to do.
Well, but. Speaking of another form, since we just went to this the cut-up form, we'll move now to what is more something along the lines of prose poems, which we had talked about you reading.
Okay. This is a prose poem, or... sometimes I call this an essay because I wrote this after watching a PBS show from the early 80s about the failures of 1970s economic policy. So it was like looking back 20 years to see them ruthlessly criticizing 30 years ago. So here we go. And all I did was I exactly copied everything from the program in my own words. So it wasn't plagiarism, it was paraphrase. I have a story to tell about how price controls on beef left America without enough beef to eat. It was reasonably priced, the beef, but there was none there. Americans were chewing their chicken, dreaming of beef. And not even the cows were happy because they were in concentration camps, just waiting, getting old and tough. This all happened in 1973, in case you thought I was committing allegory. It was all explained by a stringy old cattleman looking damn near inedible himself. Hearing a farmer talk about farming is sort of like hearing a bank teller talk about banking. All the decisions are made by the boy at the big desk because bureaucracy is everywhere, even in private businesses to which the national government has pledged unlimited support. So this old cattleman, a photogenic fellow, in the way that a cattleman's meant to be photogenic, which is to say, he moving his lips against each other, each lip chewing at the t'other lip, such that you might well imagine he had himself his own cud to chew. He was keeping those cows off the market, even if they got old. He figured the price would get better. As a matter of fact, the black market beef price went up and up. But only criminals could get young beef, because only they were immoral enough to violate the unjust laws restricting supply and demand. Beautiful, happy criminals. And that is how we defeated the Soviet Union, by proving them wrong, by imitating their policies, until children whose vegetables were too far boiled to yield them sufficient nutrients were shivering at the mere thought of beef, and fainting in fright at school in front of their plates of wobbling yellow jello because angels with the bodies of cows but the wings of angels were fluttering just above reach, aging like the sunlight ages, stuck inside yellow jello. I love a cheap epiphany, but an overpriced epiphany isn't worth a damn, not even if the free market pushes the price way up. But not to worry, because the free market continues to ensure the price of epiphanies stays low, like the price of beef. It was the price of feed that ran the price of beef up due to the droughts, such that it simply cost more to fatten up your cow. Similarly, an increase in the price of education could drive up the price of epiphanies, because you have to read James Joyce or Chekhov in order to realize that you're having them. If America went without beef or epiphanies, how sad. Like cafeterias of silence, eating without experiencing it. Epiphanies made of beef wait in the middle of the night for the man with the pan full of butter who giggles at the sight of blood. That gleeful man, on the other hand.
Yeah, this poem, it's great. I love this piece. And I have to say, for those of you that, you know, cannot be here today while we're recording this, that this poem in particular is extremely heightened by the fact that we have a disco ball rotating and shining lights around the room, and, you know, it's a really good mixture with the whole beef thing and the 70s beef crisis and all that.
Beef disco.
Disco and beef. Yeah, it's great.
It's not really a ball either, is it?
Yeah, it's a disco ball with a strange growth on one side.
It's a disco light bulb.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think you're one of the things that you do, the you know, the children in fright at school in front of their plates of wobbling yellow jello because angels with the bodies of cows but the wings of angels were fluttering just above reach. It's kind of one of those things that you do. It's a very simple technique. I mean, I'm being really close, but close read here, but your kind of repetition of the word angels there, you know, angels with the bodies of cows but the wings of angels. I mean, it goes through visually how, you know, you know, it takes the reader visually through a transformation of cow to angel just by repeating that word even once. And it's, you know, it's something that you do in other places in your poetry just by repeating a little concept, you know, beginning it and then tacking it off at the end again. So, you know.
Well, you know, I feel that poetry should use rhetorical methods at least as effective as televangelism. That's
Hail
like the
Satan.
New version. Ezra Pound said, you know, poetry should be at least as well written as prose. And I'm adding, poetry should be at least as rhetorically effective as televangelism. So they can put those things side by side.
That's really a lot to aspire to, don't you think?
Too much.
And of course, it totally leads into the last poem that you're going to read for us today, which is totally effective televangelism.
Well, let's do it. This was from after the election, and liberals were mad at one another because they lost. So, you know, naturally they got mad at one another. Who are you to tell, allowed to say that wasn't political enough before, to political anymore, that I'm not going me that me more? Who are me more political anymore than I'm allowed to say not going me that wasn't political enough to tell you more before that anymore? Who are any more to allowed say going wasn't me that enough? Tell more political, more me, I'm that, not to before. More me that I'm not, going who that allowed to. Tell more, say before that wasn't enough political, who are?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in a way, I mean, this is a great coda to the book. What's really interesting is that this book, Inferation, which we should probably talk a little bit more about the title, but this book, Inferation, like, this poem is almost the climax of the book, and then you have, I mean, it's really solid, and then you have, like, and I'm not saying the other poems after it are, like, you know, like a receding tide, but I think what's interesting about this book, and, you know, I read through it a couple times, is after this poem, I start seeing Stan going in a different direction to other poems that I've seen more recently. Like your Sprout poem is kind of reminds me more of your World Muppet Socialism project, you know. Your God, is it Confused Dude Hammers America? You know, I'm not sure where that's going, but it's it's got a different level of humor than most of the just kind of strict absurd, not strict absurdist, but then the absurdist poems that come before that. So, I mean, I mean, this poem is great for us to end here today, and it's also it's a really interesting kind of climax in the book Inforation. So, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about why you called the book Inforation.
Well, you have to call it something, and I like making up words, playing with words. I don't think that people should be, you know, bound by the lexicon to not produce more words. And, you know, Shakespeare, you know, he created a lot of words, and he's a good writer, so I can create words. But and it's important to note that the word Shakespeare created that we remember were not good words. I mean, he created words like multitudinous, which is a really lousy synonym for many. And in the same line of poetry in Macbeth, multitudinous drops incarnadine, he created incarnadine, which is a really absurd word that means red. So,
I mean, there's all these words that, you know, whatever, they can mean something for a moment, and it's okay. And most of the time we get our meaning through context anyway. And so some of the words that you use in these poems that you make up, they just, well, they mean something because they're within, they're surrounded by other words. It's the only way that words gather meaning, right, is by being around other words.
I'm also very interested in letters, you know. I mean, we have letters, and the idea of how you're supposed to read that you're taught in college is you ignore the letters, you think about the word, so you're reading as if you were speaking. But that's a fiction. I mean, we can train ourselves to read as if we were listening to a speech and not look at the letters. But then it's so fun to look at the letters and play with them. So, you know, the word information has 11 letters, and the middle one is the M, and it's the biggest letter. So I took it out because I felt that, you know, that people weren't getting information, so there must be a hole in it. So I took a letter out, and then, you know, there was something else. Inforation.
Yeah. Well, I think that's it for today, right?
Thank you so much, Sam, for
Thanks
being
for
with
having
us
me.
Today and reading your great poems, and good luck with Inforation and everything else, and thanks to Tova for being in our audience.
Thanks,
Tova and Leo.
My little unborn son Leo is here.
And please, if you're listening to this on a podcast feed, be sure to go to www.la-lit.com and check out. We'll have some videos posted and photos of Stan and some other text, some of the poems that he read, so you can see the layout of the text, and different links to some of Stan's blog projects. And yeah, just a lot more information. So we'll also have links to discussion pages where you can talk more about, you know, joining a discussion about Stan's methods and poetry. And yeah, and you can also contact us and see what upcoming shows we might have and suggest questions for the people that we have on the show. So please stop on by www.la-lit.com and find out more about Stan. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to our gracious host, Beta Level, for allowing us to use your equipment and taking the time to sit in here while we interview people. Thank you.
And also a special thanks to Super Bunker, sponsor of LA Lit. And you can find Super Bunker at www.superbunker.org. And you can find Beta Level at www.betalevel.org as well. So it's a whole internet monopoly. So find your way there and get subsumed.